A fishing vessel and some of its crew are missing in the Bering Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 22nd of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the mortgage crisis hits Alaska.
Title companies are desperate. Banks are desperate. Real estate agencies are desperate. We're all kind of desperate. And it seems like it's getting worse.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, helping customers get to the next stage through banking, loans, and retirement planning. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
The Katmai, a 92-foot cod fishing and processing vessel, and some of its 11-member crew are missing in the Bering Sea. The vessel was in Amchitka Pass, just west of Adak in the Aleutian Islands, when it went missing. The Coast Guard responded to an EPIRB signal from the ship at about 1 a.m. local time, but received no mayday calls. Coast Guard Petty Officer Wes Shin said when an MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter and a C-130 arrived from Kodiak 5 hours later, they only found an empty survival suit and part of a life raft. After searching from air for 6 hours, four survivors were found. They found the body of a crew member wearing a survival suit with the name of the vessel on the back. The body of another crew member was also found. The Good Samaritan fishing vessel Courageous is helping with the search. So far, they've found buoys, fishing gear, a life raft, a life ring, and an empty survival suit. Another Good Samaritan vessel will be in the area by 7 p.m. The Katmai is home-ported in Kodiak and was headed toward the port of Dutch Harbor. Shin cannot confirm if the vessel has sunk. A Coast Guard cutter is headed toward the area, and they will continue to search as long as weather permits. It's been snowing and raining there since the search began. This was the second year the boat fished cod using pots in the parallel cod fishery in state waters. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game says the ship was captained by Henry Blake III and was owned by a company based in Washington. The subprime loan crisis has made it to Alaska. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation says it unwittingly bought bad loans earlier this year, and it's cracking down on lenders that don't meet its credit guidelines. In Juneau, some homebuyers can't get credit, and that's hurting the real estate industry and others. KTOO's Weld Royal has the story.
Chuck Ramich has sold real estate in Juneau for the last 16 years. He says it's never been so bad.
Title companies are desperate. Banks are desperate. Real estate agencies are desperate. We're all kind of desperate. And it seems like it's getting worse.
Ramich says two real estate firms have closed in the last year and agents are leaving town. Others are seeking second jobs. He says deals that looked good are disappearing because buyers find they can't get credit.
Lots of deals falling through. You'll be into a loan and you'll get close to closing. All of a sudden, the bank won't come up with the money.
Realtors aren't the only ones hurting from a dearth of deals. Jim Canary is former tax assessor for the city and borough of Juneau and now runs a real estate appraisal company. He's hired to estimate a home's value after a deal is reached between buyer and seller. He hasn't had much work in the last few months.
It's been, you know, August and September were very slow in our office, actually even July.
The housing market in Juneau slowed in 2007 when sales volume was down compared to a year earlier. In the first 3 months of 2008, prices also fell, according to multiple listing service data. Honeybee Anderson has almost two decades of real estate experience in Juneau. She says home sales are slow due to the global credit crunch and local economic problems. She points to the energy emergency that temporarily resulted in higher power prices in Juneau earlier this year and recent layoffs at the Kensington Gold Mine. Anderson hopes the federal financial bailout will jumpstart Juneau's real estate market by mid-November. She says she's planning on a busy early 2009. Signs from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation may dampen that enthusiasm. Lori Holte is a residential lending officer at AHFC. The corporation functions in Alaska like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and backs loans underwritten by banks and mortgage companies. Holte says applications have plummeted recently.
We've also seen a drastic drop-off within the last, say, several weeks or a month. Up until October, we issued 331 commitments in the month of September. That was right about where we would be, but we're tracking considerably less than that for this month.
She doesn't see things changing quickly. Holte says AHFC's rates for traditional mortgages at mid-month were higher than those backed by competitors Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. The corporation's rates are driven by the bond market, and its wild swings have made it hard to predict.
There's just no telling with the market as volatile as it's been here for the past couple of weeks.
Holte also says AHFC is scrutinizing potential loans after it realized lenders were sending it high-risk mortgages from poorly qualified candidates. In a memo issued earlier this month, officials pointed to an alarming trend of deterioration in the underwriting of AHFC loans, with many lenders disregarding the corporation's guidelines. It says it will require lenders to buy back loans if it finds credit rules were violated. AHFC's enhanced scrutiny has created confusion in the real estate industry. To help explain its credit qualifications, its senior staff is holding a meeting on Thursday in the corporation's boardroom in Anchorage to answer questions. In Juneau, I'm Wells Royal.
Alaskans can get a look at two investigations into high energy prices tomorrow at a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee in Anchorage. The panel will hear details of a Department of Law investigation to find out if there has been price fixing in the gasoline and diesel retail industry. In an interview on APRN 10 days ago, Assistant Attorney General Ed Sniffen pointed out that the state has no control over the prices that retailers charge for products. However, it can determine whether those prices were the result of illegal collusion among marketers. Committee members are also scheduled to hear from personnel at the state's refineries to determine if the state's policies and requirements are adding to the high prices to consumers. The meeting begins at 9:30 tomorrow in the Legislative Information Office in Anchorage. Sound from the hearing will be available on the Gavel to Gavel website at ktoo.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, weighing the right way to fund fixing the state's highways and bridges.
The state does have quite a few deficient bridges that need repairs.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
Senator Ted Stevens' fate is now in the hands of a Washington, D.C. jury. Judge Emmett Sullivan read jurors' 81 pages of instructions this morning before the 8 women and 4 men went behind closed doors to deliberate. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The final jury has 7 African-American women, 3 African-American men, 1 white woman, and 1 Hispanic man. It's a far different makeup than the demographic of Alaska, where less than 4% of the population is black. Judge Sullivan dismissed the 4 alternates Wednesday morning. They were chosen at random at the beginning of the trial and included the 1 white male in the group. The jury picked its own foreperson. It appears to be a middle-aged African-American man who said during the selection process that he previously served on a grand jury and on a jury before Judge Sullivan. The group began deliberating around noon after Sullivan told them they are the sole judges of the facts. He said the verdict of the case is their sole and exclusive responsibility. They deliberated until about 4 o'clock Wednesday when they sent a note to the judge asking if they could leave early. Judge Sullivan read the note in open court. The foreman wrote that things were kind of stressful and that the jurors needed a minute of clarity for all. The judge agreed they could leave for the day, reminding them not to talk to anyone about the case, even other jurors outside the jury room. They'll return to the courthouse Thursday morning at 9:30 to pick up where they left off. The group will deliberate daily from 9:30 to 4:45 with a lunch break every weekday until they reach a verdict. The jury must reach a unanimous conclusion on each of the 7 charges. They can convict Stevens on some and find him not guilty of others. Each charge carries a possible sentence of 5 years in prison, although jurors aren't allowed to consider punishment in their deliberations. The first count alleges Stephen schemed to conceal information on his financial disclosure forms. The rest of the counts break down the charges by year, starting with Stephen's 2001 form. Jurors must determine if Stephen knowingly and willfully made false or fraudulent statements when he filled out the mandatory information. On each of the forms, Stephen was required to disclose gifts over a certain amount of money, ranging from $260 to $305, depending on the year. The government says he failed to report items like a massage chair, a stained glass window, and renovations to his Girdwood house. Stevens isn't directly charged with lying about a couple of items jurors heard about during the trial, including the alleged gift of a generator. But jurors are allowed to consider those items as they look at the big picture. The government says things like the generator show Stevens' conduct and show proof of motive or intent. The same goes for a sweetheart loan Stevens allegedly received in connection with a Florida real estate deal, and instances where Vico CEO Bill Allen allegedly got Stevens' son a job and paid for his grandson's job training. They can show a pattern of conduct. How the jury chooses to tackle the case and sift through all the information is up to them. The trial lasted a month and included testimony of more than 50 witnesses, 32 for the defense and 24 for the prosecution. Evidence includes audio recordings, emails, letters, invoices, checks, and appraisals, floor plans, and photos of Stephen's Girdwood home. It all comes into play now as the jurors weigh Stephen's guilt or innocence. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
While choosing among the candidates on Election Day, voters will also decide whether the state should go into debt to pay for $315 million in transportation projects. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
If voters approve the ballot question, it'll be the first time since 2002 that the state has issued bonds. And it'll set the course for work to start on completing a list of 27 projects, plus an unspecified number of repair jobs that cover the state. House Rules Chairman John Coghill says he voted against the idea twice during the session, and he'll vote against it one more time on the ballot. He says now is not the time to borrow money. The state could have paid cash for the projects on the list during the session this year, and he says there's no reason to go into debt.
Our market hangs pretty precariously on some cash issues, so I think you go ahead and you put the money into the long-term projects when you have the cash, and then when you don't have the cash, then you ask yourself the question, what should we borrow money for that is the basic need? And public safety, roads, schools, those are our basic responsibility. And to borrow money for them when we have the cash just, to me, seemed the wrong thing to do.
However, Associated General Contractors Executive Director John McKinnon says now is the time to borrow money. First of all, because the state needs to use its credit rating to help other entities, such as municipalities, keep their bond costs low. He also says transportation is a major infrastructure investment that'll affect everyone in the state in some way. And the projects the bonds will pay for come from all parts of the state.
There's Ketchikan, Juneau, Nome, and out clear out in Olecnagik, an important bridge. There's a $20 million pot for statewide bridge repairs, and you know that the state does have quite a few deficient bridges that need repairs. Anchorage congestion issues. You know, Kenai Peninsula's got some borough road projects there. You know, replacing a bridge in the industrial area of Nome. University Avenue in Fairbanks, that's something that has been high on the Fairbanks borough's priority list for years.
The package provides $20 million in bridge repairs around the state, $36 million for Anchorage roads, and another $10 million for the Port of Anchorage expansion. The Glen Highway, the Parks Highway, the Seward Highway, the Dalton Highway, and the Steese Highway all will be improved. McKinnon says those are high priorities to the areas in which they're located. Coghill says, as high priorities, he expects they'll be back before the legislature next year. But the projects are before voters to approve now. And Eagle River's Anna Fairclough says this is the time to bond. She describes it as good for the infrastructure and the financial needs of communities.
the interest rates are low, and they may be lower, and it will assist other parts of our state in acquiring lower debt bonding that they'll have to do, specifically in the Anchorage area, to support continuing maintenance on their schools. So we want to make sure that we actually have a good credit rating out there in Alaska.
Although the concept of issuing bonds originated with Governor Palin this session, she did not have the option of doing any line item vetoes on the list of projects when she signed it. The list voters will see was created by the legislature, and voters will have the same choice as the governor, to accept or reject it. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra says voters need to look at what's on that list. He says there are some very important projects, such as a bridge connecting Dillingham and Aleknagik, but there also is a lot of pork.
Legislators from powerful areas, some of the more powerful areas, say, look, in order to help the Bethels of the world, in order to help the Dillinghams of the world, we're not going to help you unless we get more money for our areas. And, you know, I object to that kind of governing. You fund the highest need places first, and, you know, at some point this bill got way, way, way too big.
The bill began as a $140 million proposal from the governor. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Wrangell is making plans to rebuild parts of its downtown. The southeast city of about 2,100 people hopes to upgrade streets, sidewalks, utilities, and landscaping over the next few years. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the details.
Wrangell officials have been making plans for years to revitalize their downtown business district. Economic Development Director Carol Rushmore says the work is needed.
We have a lot of infrastructure problems that we need to deal with. The streets are bad. The sidewalks are bad. We have some utility work that needs to be done. And so we were trying to put it all into one project to do some great improvements and then to work with businesses to hopefully where they will do some improvements as well.
City officials are working with contractors to fine-tune what's to be done, but the project is officially state-run, which worries some local leaders.
We spent almost a year working out a memorandum of agreement with the state so that the city could be sure that our interests were represented and that we would have say in the things that we wanted, because it is our downtown street. It's not a state highway or anything. It's our downtown commercial corridor. And so we wanted to make sure that we would have the input necessary so that the project would be what we want.
The state engineer overseeing the project could not be immediately reached for comment. Rushmore says environmental and engineering work should be completed by the end of next year. She hopes construction will begin in the spring of 2010, with the actual work taking no more than another year. The original plan was to replace about a mile of streets, sidewalks, and utilities, in addition to safety and other upgrades. But that's been scaled back due to rising costs. The project's multi-million-dollar funding is coming from several state and federal agencies, though part of that money will go to other work around the community. Rushmore says the complexity of funding and ever-changing costs mean she does not yet have a total price.
At this point in time, we don't know fully. And the reason being the costs of materials has gone up considerably since we did our sort of a preliminary engineering estimate several years ago. We've had to reduce the extent of the project due to some of the costs. We, you know, not having enough funds to do the entire length of the road. And so I cannot give you a figure right now.
Wrangell officials plan a November meeting to discuss plans and hear what residents have to say. Rushmore says public comments will help fine-tune project parameters.
It's a scoping meeting to look at, you know, impacts, to look at issues, to try to, you know, get from the community as a whole. But at the same time, they will be talking to some of the business owners that will be directly affected, but the whole community affected, because this is our commercial corridor. This is sort of the central location that our community does business in.
The community meeting will be from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Tuesday, November 18th at Wrangell's Nolan Center. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention gets officially underway tomorrow in Anchorage, but that doesn't mean that there's any lack of activities related to the convention going on beforehand. The First Alaskans Institute is sponsoring a series of panel discussions on Native perspectives on statehood in recognition of the state's 50th anniversary. Byron Malott, Vic Fisher, and Liz Cheney headed a discussion panel in Anchorage aimed at understanding the impact statehood had and continues to have on Natives. Malott said statehood came at a time when Alaska Natives were discriminated against, therefore they were left out of the process.
And the reality was that Alaska Natives were not accepted.
Malott, who has had a career in public service since he was mayor of Yakutat, said there is no representation of Alaska Natives on the state seal, something that is reflected in the area of social and public policy toward Natives today. Malott is a senior fellow with the Alaska Native Policy Center. The center's current director, Liz Cheney, said many young Alaska Natives feel no connection whatsoever to the state. Cheney says she struggles with a balance of wanting to be positive about the future of the state of Alaska and the future of Alaska Natives. She says it is important that Natives speak out about their feelings.
The way our role is going to change, whether people like it or not, because we're starting to talk about it. It's been going on. It's been going on in my house. It's been going on around our kitchen tables. But now we're sharing it with others who are in the state of Alaska and who, despite not knowing or being Native, find something about us that they just love, in the same way that in our culture we adopt people into our families.
Cheney said the history of Alaska Natives is 10,000 years old. While the 50 years of statehood is a landmark, it is just a fraction of that time. She said that Alaska Natives have been considered a federal, not a state, responsibility.
I'm bringing this up because I think that's a really, valid connection to what we can talk about in the past as something moving through 50 years, year by year, day by day, and not really having that changed because we're still not acknowledged by the state as tribal governments, as tribal people. We're acknowledged as residents of the state on an individual level. And maybe as individuals, maybe that's our opportunity to say that it's no longer acceptable.
Audience participation was encouraged during the discussion. The First Alaskans Institute wants to find out and record what Native people think about statehood's strengths and shortcomings and what they think the next 50 years will bring. Blending Alaska Native culture with modern technology was at the heart of a recent workshop in Nome. The program encourages local artists to leverage the power of the internet for higher profiles and better sales. Paul Korchin from KNOM in Nome has more.
How do you sell something like a genuine Western Alaska walking stick online for a good price?
When they type the keyword search in eBay, what are the key search terms? I'm thinking walking stick is one. Gnome. What else? What are our other keywords? Alaska. What's the other keyword that we're missing? I think Iditarod.
Former Nomeite Joseph Davis this month spent 3 days in Nome teaching folks from the region how to market and sell their local artwork in the modern-day virtual universe. Davis now lives in Anchorage and runs Watermark Consulting, aimed at bridging business and technology. A walking stick was just one of several product examples Davis used for his lessons. Wilma Osborne from White Mountain was among the attendees and said her introduction to the virtual market was informative.
I've known about eBay for a long time, but I don't really know how to use it, you know, and it's like a culture that you've never had any experience in. You know, and anytime you go to a website, it's like a place.
Davis indicated getting that place to appreciate the cultural richness of Western Alaska is an important selling point for the local entrepreneur.
Over time, he's going to get to a place where his description is pretty easy to write. He uses his stock paragraphs, but it'll take a few times to do this. Now, if I sold a lot of walking sticks, I'd probably get better at it too.
Osborne felt encouraged by how the internet can be leveraged in support of traditional values.
I see it as a way for people to, in the village, to keep their culture alive by doing their art. And by doing art, you're involving a lot of people in it because it takes materials. You end up gathering them through hunting parties. People go out and catch a seal. Then it'll take someone to clean the hide. And then it takes someone to make something out of it. You know, it's really true that it takes a whole community to create artwork.
Davis says web-based markets permit Alaska Native artists to make their own voices heard around the world.
To empower people to take the skill sets of business and technology and culture, learning how to sell Native art on eBay. And it's not just about selling on eBay, it's about selling for more. And we do this by telling the story of the cultural richness of the art, of the artist, of where the materials came from, to raise the value. And it's really telling a richer story from the perspective of the culture itself, as opposed to from a store in Anchorage, a store in Seattle.
Davis notes local beading artist Colleen Oten has had over 150 successful transactions on eBay so far. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission met yesterday for the first time with residential school survivors in northern British Columbia. The meeting came the day after the commission's leader resigned. Justice Harry Laforme said he wanted to focus on reconciliation while his two commissioners want to uncover and document truth. From the CBC, Betsy Trumpener has more.
I can only tell you that I will do what I can to...
Commissioner Jane Morley told this crowd she shares their disappointment at Justice Harry Laforme's resignation and their fear that it could slow the truth-telling and reconciliation.
To move us along and to keep our eye on what is important here, which is that it's a process for the survivors. It's not a process that is dependent on any one person or any three people.
Chief Robert Joseph is a residential school survivor now working with the commission.
I know that we've been distracted by the resignation, as regrettable as that is and as disappointing as that is. All we need to do is to remind the powers that be that they ought to, as quickly and as soon as possible, appoint another person to the commission.
Today's headlines about the change in commission leadership hasn't changed the resolve of hundreds of people gathered here today to tell their stories. Betsy Trumpener, CBC News, Prince George.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to let us know if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Weld Royal and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Paul Korchin in Nome, and the CBC's Betsy Trumpener in Prince George. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage, and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org. In celebration of Alaska's 50th anniversary of statehood, the Governor's Legacy Dinner will be held on November 14th at the Hotel Captain Cook. All eight of the living governors of Alaska will be in attendance for this elegant and prestigious event. Enjoy world-class entertainment, gourmet dining, and special anniversary gifts. For more information and to make your reservation to the Alaska Governor's Legacy Dinner, log on to alaskaturns50.com. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Statehood Celebration Committee.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.